Welcome to Body Matters Podcast, where we bring to you raw and inspiring content on all things to do with body positivity and eating disorder recovery.
But before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as traditional people and traditional owners of this country. We acknowledge with gratitude First Nations communities for their continuing care and connection to the lands or waters with which they have protected for thousands of years. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and recognize that First Nations sovereignty was never ceded.
On this week's episode, I am super excited to be introducing you to our next special guest, psychologist Kathy Anderson. Kathy has worked in the field of eating disorders for the last 20 years as a senior clinician, senior psychologist, and eating disorder coordinator. Kathy has also been a guest lecturer at Wollongong University and the University of Sydney, as well as has contributed to multiple projects in the eating disorder space, such as in the development and implementation of the statewide New South Wales Eating Disorder Plan. On this week's episode, Kathy will be speaking about the topic of compassion and self-compassion. As someone who is very passionate about the role that compassion can have in our lives. So please welcome our next special guest, Kathy.
So thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Kathy.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Would you be able to provide a little background information about yourself and maybe speak about some things that you like to do to stay well?
Okay, well, I've been a psychologist for 25 years, but in that process, yeah, I've had three children. So, you know, there's been little tiny breaks in between doing that. But essentially, I've worked in the eating disorder sphere since 2001. So it's been the bulk of my time practicing as a psychologist. And I even did my research for my master's in eating disorders. So, you know, even before I was registered, I was interested in eating disorders. So certainly wasn't my first, wasn't my first paid gig to work in eating disorders. That's, I went through rehabilitation psychology and neuropsychology in one of the local hospitals in this really great department, which was, you know, wonderful early working experience. And I think that particular team, even though it wasn't where, you know, the content of the work wasn't where I thought I wanted to be, as a grounding as a clinician, it was just such a fantastic opportunity. And I think it shaped a lot of how I've become in my clinical work. So it's interesting, you know, getting to things that you don't think you're going to, and there's the universe saying there's a reason for this.
Yeah, you have such an array of experience.
Yeah, well, I mean, as I said, the bulk of my time's been in eating disorders. And, you know, my initial interest in eating disorders came from, as a teenager, a really close friend developed an eating disorder, but I didn't know that until she ended up in hospital. Wow. And I remember as a teenager being absolutely dumbfounded that one of my close friends, that I wouldn't know this, right? And it's like, how is it that I could have missed it? So that's kind of where my first experience was with eating disorders. And I was like, she's a good person from a good family. This is a horrible condition, and as her really good friend, I didn't see it. That, you know, it really baffled me as a teenager. So I didn't realize at the time that I actually had quite an open-minded way of looking at her experience of an eating disorder. But I think that, you know, it's also interesting that there were a lot of biases in the 1990s. Now I'm giving things away about myself. and, you know, that a lot of, you know, stigma and bias has actually led to inaccurate judgments about people with eating disorders. And that's what kind of feeds into my work as well, is like I've always been kind of quite curious about why people might struggle with stigma and bias in the healthcare system and not actually see the whole person. So that's kind of my basic background in eating disorders. Worked in the public system for a lot of years and worked with workforce development and, you know, supervised psychologists in the eating disorder world, that kind of thing. And that's been really interesting. And then, you know, more recently, I think it's the last 3 or 4 years, I've been working in private practice.
Nice. And did you ever speak to that friend about what was happening for her, or was it just kind of becoming aware of eating disorders?
I think it was very difficult to know as a teenager what to do. The talking about it was probably, you know, in hindsight, I wish I'd been able to do more with that. But that has contributed also to how I actually think about my clients' families, their interactions with their people in their world. I was a empathetic person, but I didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah, so it was like that first kind of learning for you. And back in that time, it just wasn't spoken about.
It wasn't. It definitely wasn't. It was very, you know, it was hush. And, you know, if I knew that she was having another hospitalization, it just wasn't a thing that was spoken about. It's quite extraordinary to think about the fact that, you know, here and now we would actually encourage people to find their appropriate supports. You know, who is it that you can talk with? And you know, parents too. Who is it that the parents can talk to? Is there shame about this? Does there need to be shame about this? Can we actually support families to be able to be more open so that they can be supported too? And I think there's that reach of time where, you know, people didn't really talk about eating disorders. Now we're saying, well, we should talk about it.
Yes, but I still think there might be some people who still struggle to talk to their friends and families that open up, and 100%. It just shows how much they really need it.
Yes, and that's why it's important for us as healthcare professionals to bring that conversation to the table to help people understand it's important for them to find who it is that they can, you know, share some time with around this stuff, that it doesn't necessarily have to be a thing of shame and secrecy, and that actually the secrecy is the thing that will maintain the eating disorder in the long run.
I think so. And there are a lot of people that do understand eating disorders these days, and you might be surprised in people's responses.
Yes, absolutely.
And I know it may be a very long time ago to talk about, but do you remember what you did in your master's and your research in eating disorders?
Oh, I did. The interest for me was that I came to understand that people didn't know where to go or who to turn to when they realised that their young person had an eating disorder. So we're talking pre-internet. I'm giving away more secrets. But it was really fascinating to think, like, how do people find information? How do they know who to ask? And how do they know where to go? And so my research was working with a psychologist whose space was in eating disorders. And he very kindly, you know, recruited me some clients and some families. And it was getting their perspective on that. So in the end, what we did, I ended up a few years later working with the Illawarra Eating Disorder Service. And what we did there was we actually set up a phone line that was like a pre-recorded phone line, because that's what you did in those days. And it had information on services and where they might be able to get help for people in the Illawarra area. So that was a nice little outcome. I mean, there was no There's no money that supported that. It was just that it was a community-based service that kind of said, that's a great idea, let's try it. And then we used to kind of monitor that phone line and we'd see how many calls we'd get in a week. And we ran it, I think, for about 4 years until the internet arrived.
Sounds amazing. It sounds like there was work being done and recognition of it back then.
Yeah, yeah. But we didn't have any way of collecting the data of what happened after that. It was, we literally were looking at, was the phone line getting hits? And it was. And, you know, then we just hope. That's what it was a very basic kind of service, but it was just a way of trying to get some information out there so that it would reduce that barrier to people seeking their first steps to care.
Yes, and I think there's still barriers in seeking care, like when you meet a GP, if they recognise eating disorders or not.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And so it fascinates me to think back, gosh, how many barriers there were back then. And even with all of these lines of communication that we have now, and, you know, there's a an upsurge in interest in eating disorders and, you know, an understanding that we all have a role to play in eating disorder care, and there's still barriers. So, you know, I think we've come a long way and we've still got work to do on that plane as well.
I think we do. And back onto the self-care, do you have any self-care that you could share?
Yeah. For me, it's self-care is very much about remaining connected to people. I'm quite a social person. So I know that I really value time with family, friends, and my community. So what I didn't realize until I was actually looking at this question, that I actually really value contributing time to community organizations. And you know, I do that with my family, with my kids, my husband. And because when you create connections in community settings and your kids are creating connections, their connections are your connections, right? And you never know who you're going to meet. You never know where you're going to find, you know, people that fit in your life. And so, you know, I realize that I really value those community connections quite apart from, you know, my family and my long-term friends. So, you know, on a smaller scale, I go for a walk once a week with one of my good friends and we walk at dawn, because that's the time that's available to us. But it's also at the beach, so it's beautiful, right? Like really, I really feel very connected when I go to the beach. I occasionally will find time to do something creative with some of my creative friends. And that's, you know, that's been a long-term love of mine and I don't get a lot of time to do it, but I know that's a little injection that I really value, that I recognize as a form of self-care. And then the really basic one is like having a cup of tea at the end of the night and reading my book. I love that. I love that at the end of the night. And, you know, it might be 10 minutes, but I recognize for me that that's a really lovely 10 minutes that I might have that is just for me and I can read whatever I want.
Yes. And I love that you linked your values to self-care, which is really nice to see.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the other thing that's self-care that's on the larger scale is that I really value exploration. And so traveling for me is one of those things, and that's not something you can do every day, but, you know, having that kind of long-term goal, you know, looking forward to that and then immersing yourself in that and taking a break away from everyday stuff, that's also a form of self-care for me. But I realize that that's, you know, there's a lot of planning and saving that goes on in between for those ones.
Yes, it does. But it seems like you'd want to come back to all those community-based self-care forms when you come back to.
Absolutely. Absolutely. For me, I understand that my self-care is based around connection with other people.
Yes. And when you do travel, like, it is amazing experiences and connections. But yeah, there's a part of your core connections and communities that you're a part of that really kind of stay with you.
Yep, and draw you back home.
Yes.
Yep.
So each week on the podcast, we do like to ask our guests about a recent challenge that they've experienced and how they have managed to overcome it. Do you have one?
Yeah, this is an interesting question because as all good psychologists, I reflected on the questions you gave me. And when I was considering what my recent challenge might be, I had a couple that popped up, and one of them was a really brief but quite considerable challenge, and one is an extended challenge. And so when I was thinking about these, I realized that I actually have very similar coping strategies for both of those things. It didn't matter that one was brief and one has been extended. So contextually, the extended challenge has been, my aging parents and my father's ailing health. So, moving into a role where essentially you kind of step into some kind of caring role. And then my brief challenge was when there was a stuff up at the airport a couple of weeks ago, and we'd booked parking and we arrived at the parking was full. And so our flight was like in an hour and 20 and we were due to go through and check in, but we had no parking. So, in both of these circumstances, you notice that there's times where your anxiety gets elevated, you're overthinking things, you might feel like things are out of control, that you might not be able to solve the problems. And in both of those situations, I realized that I do take a deep breath and I do try and step back and see the big picture, because whether it's a long-term or it's a short-term challenge, we can get hyper-focused, right? And hyper-focus on what is wrong, as opposed to stepping back and considering what can I do? There's always something that we can do, but can we actually step back and zoom out enough to see the big picture to recognize that there will be something that I can do? So this helps me take perspective, and then I can actually access both my thoughts and my emotions at the same time. So try and take both of those things into account. And then I find that my thoughts and my emotions don't run away from me, and I can actually stay in charge and access, some kind of executive function that helps me come to some kind of conclusion. And I realize that I'm very much a communicator. So whether I'm talking, whether I'm collaborating, whether I'm venting, like, let's be honest, we're all human, whichever seems appropriate at the time, my tendency is to, communicate with somebody else about what that issue is and make sure that what it is that I'm thinking is also, in line with what other people might think is conducive to some kind of, reasonable outcome. And then lastly, the thing that I noticed is that there's a time and place for our bodies to actually be a part of helping us get through challenges. And whether that's, a time for tears, whether it's a time for moving your body, for grounding yourself or connecting to somebody else with a hug. Our bodies are intrinsically involved in challenges, right? And so if we can actually use those to help us also get through our challenges, it's like we kind of close the circuit, we finish off the circuit. It's funny to reflect that in both the long-term and short-term challenges, I seem to use those strategies.
That's a great strategy, being able to kind of remove yourself from getting stuck in the emotions and actually step back and really have a look at the situation. And I guess I wanted to ask you, how did you get out of the parking airport situation? What was the ending?
Well, apparently we were going to get upgraded to valet parking
Wow.
Which, when we arrived there, was also full and a long line of cars in a similar situation. And then my husband just decided we were going to go back to where we booked our parking. And we were going to say, listen, but the bollard had been taken away, the QR code scanned on the boom gate, and we just got in. I think it was, I don't know, the universe was looking after us and we got through.
As soon as you calmed down and had a look.
Yeah, because we tried to problem solve it. Like, I even tried to go up to the where we'd been sent the second time, and I was trying to say, you know, what's the plan here? What else can we do? And they were just like, hands off.
Oh,
we're booked too. We're full. So they weren't problem solving for us. But yeah, taking a step back and just kind of going, let's go back to plan one. Let's see what happens. Surely cars have got to leave from there.
Yes. And that would give anyone anxiety, like a plane leaving.
Yes.
Oh my. It's like, how do I solve myself?
Yeah, I've never been in a situation like that before. But you know, and it wasn't just me, it was a collaborative piece of work, that one. But the, you know, we were pretty exhausted later that day. And I would say as a result of a significant amount of adrenaline.
Oh, your body would be so much going on.
Yep, absolutely. But hey, we were the lucky ones in the end.
Yeah, true. Made the flight.
Made the flight.
They have more parking next time.
I know.
On the topic of today, we are going to be speaking about self-compassion. So I guess could you talk about what self-compassion is?
Yeah, look, self-compassion is... I think in order for us to understand self-compassion, we need to first understand compassion, right? And I will, you know, talk with clients about this as well, because, you know, self-compassion can feel almost repulsive to some people.
True.
You know, it can be a very strong reaction when you start to talk to people about self-compassion.
Yes.
Right. It's really fascinating. So this is why I always kind of go back to compassion first. And compassion is an innate thing that we experience as human beings, right? And it's a deep awareness of suffering of another person, coupled with the desire to actually relieve that. Right. So when we notice that someone is suffering and we want to do something about it, that's not necessarily us going, oh, it's important that I do something about this. This is a really inbuilt thing. And you see it in little kids, like you see it in tiny children who, you know, one falls over and hurts themselves and the other little toddler goes over and pats them. You know, there is this innate desire in human beings to relieve suffering. And so self-compassion actually involves the capacity to soothe and comfort and validate ourselves. It's making that U-turn with that innate ability that we already have, but allowing it to be applied to ourselves. It might also be about protecting ourselves. It might be about providing for ourselves. It might be motivating ourselves. That's self-compassion is all of those things. Right? When things go wrong in our lives, it's that wish to relieve it for ourselves. And while it is natural, it's also a learned thing. So we, you know, our environment can actually increase our capacity for compassion and self-compassion. And it can also be nurtured. So this is the really lovely thing about self-compassion. You know, if we feel like we just cannot do it, or if someone is repulsed by the idea of, you know, I don't deserve that, we can actually help people to develop that. But I'm always reminding people that this is something that is already in you. And so it's not like you have to learn it from scratch. There's already an internal knowing about this.
Yes. And I guess then what isn't self-compassionate?
Right. So if you're not self-compassionate, then you're critical of yourself. You're judgmental of yourself. You are harsh. You are unforgiving of yourself. right? And these, you know, expectations that are beyond manageable, right, is an absence of self-compassion as well. So compassion is fundamental to us as human beings, right? And compassion is being recognized as just as important as, you know, psychological dimensions and medical dimensions of the self, that compassion can actually move us towards or away from wellness.
Yes, definitely. And then why might people who experience disordered eating maybe struggle with being self-compassionate?
Well, as you may be familiar with, people with eating disorders are often highly critical of themselves, right? And it's part and parcel of the condition, right, to be self-critical. And if we think about just as basic human beings, we are our own harshest critics, right? I think most people would agree with that, that we are harder oftentimes on ourselves than we are on other people. And when we see people with eating disorders and the rules that they have for themselves and the rules they have for other people, we oftentimes see this huge divide between how hard they are on themselves and how hard they are on somebody else. And, you know, I will ask people, you know, if I can hear in their descriptions of themselves, you know, this kind of overwhelming self-criticism and sometimes, you know, to the point of self-hatred, you know, I might just slot in a little question like, oh, if this situation was happening to, you know, someone who was important to you, like a best friend, or, you know, maybe there's someone else they've already described as having a close relationship with, you know, I say, if it was happening to them, would you feel the same way towards them about that? And they go, oh, God, no. You know, so oftentimes there is this response and they go, I wouldn't be like that to anyone else. And then, you know, they go, oh, yeah, maybe I am quite hard on myself. So holding emotional states like anger and hatred towards yourself, which we can see in eating disorders, and towards their bodies, like people can't hold these two opposite views of themselves. They can't hold compassion and hatred of themselves at the same time, right? So as we actually increase self-compassion, so we decrease anger and hatred, right? And there's a metaphor in a paper, I don't know if I can pronounce his name properly, Ozawa De Silva. It's a 2012 paper, so it's a little bit old now, but he says, just as increasing the heat in a room naturally reduces the coldness there, or increasing the light decreases the darkness, so does the reduction in anger or hatred create space for compassion, and an increase in compassion reduces anger and hatred. And I think that's just such a beautiful way of seeing the role of compassion. Everyone can understand when we turn a light on that it reduces darkness. Yeah. And that when we turn the heat on, it reduces the coldness. We all have experiences of that. So that helps us with this concept that we're, you know, trying to help someone to bring in to their lives more so, that there is this kind of feature that as they bring more of that in, that it can help reduce the self-hatred, the anger, those negative emotional states that they have about themselves. But as I said, because eating disorders are so often, they come along with this strong sense of being against the self, I see, you know, self-compassion as an antidote to that. But we have to find a way to get somebody to want to introduce that back into their life.
Yes. And I guess how would you go about then trying to start that mm-hmm. process with someone?
Mm-hmm. So I do utilize motivational enhancement techniques. And, you know, it's, people are never going to adequately change for somebody else, right? You know how, you know, people might come into treatment to, you know, relieve their parents' anxiety or to get someone off their back or because the doctor told them that they had to do it, right? And we know that change isn't going to occur unless a person can find the reasons for themselves. And in the same vein, I could tell somebody that self-compassion is a good idea, but that's not going to be sufficient for someone to actually go, oh, okay, Kath, just whatever you say, I'll do it.
That is.
So the motivational enhancement techniques, you know, including, you know, looking at what it is that, say, that they don't like about their eating disorder. What is it that has held them back about the eating disorder? Versus, in fact, what is it that they've liked about their eating disorder or how has it helped them? I think it's really important that we acknowledge that the eating disorder has provided, it's functional, so it's provided the person with something. It might have been a reprieve. It might have been safety. It might have been predictability. It might have been a whole heap of things, right? So if we can also do that around compassion and why they haven't been able to allow space for self-compassion and why the anger has been important, for example, or the self-hatred, why has that been important? What's been the function of that for them? And if they can see an alternative to that, that they might be interested in, then they have an opportunity to choose to try out what it is that you're talking about with self-compassion.
Yes. So it's like acknowledging the dark and the purpose of something to then kind of bring it to light and kind of integrate it out.
Yep. Yep, for sure.
And I guess then could you talk a little bit about stress and maybe difficult emotions and that influence on somebody's ability to be self-compassionate?
So with stress, I think, you know, we think about the psychological and physical stress that occurs in eating disorders, right? And so whether this is, you know, coupled with malnutrition, there's the stress associated with that and cognitive changes that are associated with that, or there's, you know, the stress that's associated with increased anxiety, you know, if someone's binging and purging and also restricting and the body is in a state of, oh my goodness, I don't know when I'm actually going to get adequate nutrition, the body is under stress, right? So when we're under stress, our brains and our bodies are going for survival. And when we're going for survival, there are kind of, there's really ancient mechanisms, if you like, that are at play in the brain and the body. So, you know, it's exceedingly difficult for someone to eat, or it's exceedingly difficult for someone to change their mind, or it's difficult for them to interpret their behaviors. And whatever's happening with the eating, so, you know, say the starvation or the binging, purging, whatever's going on, that increases or intensifies those difficulties that they have, right? And when we are stressed, I think we can all relate that when we're stressed, do we think clearly? Are we able to problem solve easily? Do we make decisions well? I feel like most people would go, yeah, I might agree that it's difficult to do those things when we're stressed, right? And when we're stressed, we often see that that is accompanied by self-criticism too, right? So I think that when you've got an elevation of stress and the brain and the body's going into survival mode, you know, self-compassion isn't necessarily the first thing somebody's going to think of.
No, but I feel like if you do practice it, if it's, you know, a part of you wants to soothe those emotions and being able to, at some level, kind of bring in that self-compassion and in understanding that this situation's kind of okay and allowing it
Yep.
can really help.
Yeah. And that's the thing about facilitating self-compassion is that we know that we can practice it and we can increase it and we can increase our ability to engage in self-compassion. But for somebody with an eating disorder who might have that self-loathing, we need to actually help them come to a place where they want to give themselves that opportunity to soothe themselves or feel like they're deserving of that compassion.
Yes, definitely. And then how maybe can someone begin to use self-compassion?
So I would normally talk to people about the fact that if you imagine, you know, I mentioned this earlier. If you imagine your friend is struggling with something, what would you say to them? How would you behave towards them? What would you want for them? Right? So you're trying to help them connect to that part of themselves who has genuine care and regard for somebody who is important to them. And you know, the next question after they've kind of gone through those processes is what would it be like to actually receive some of that kindness or compassion that you give to others? What would it be like if you felt like you were failing or you were inadequate at something and you received that kindness? What would that feel like? And we're asking people to include themselves in that circle of compassion. That doesn't mean that they can just do it.
No.
But I think that, you know, if we can talk to them about their connections, their relationships with other people, you look at what their interactions are like with other people. You're looking at the client's strengths, even when they think they don't have any. You can hear how they care about other people. And you also know that they don't really want other people to feel burdened, right? A lot of people with eating disorders will talk about their fear of burdening other people with their illness. And so when I hear them speak about their empathy and compassion for other people and them not wanting to burden others, then I will talk to them about, well, you know, if you possess these attributes of feeling this for somebody else, could you consider using this for yourself? It would mean that you could create some self-sufficiency if they're worried about burden, right? If you don't want to burden somebody else and you don't want to depend on someone else to soothe you, is there a way that you could do that yourself? Self-compassion could be one of the ways that you could do that. And again, I'd be reiterating, you already possess these skills. I hear it in the way you talk about X, Y, and Z. So you're using that kind of information that you hear from them of how you know that they have those strengths already.
Yes. And I love also looking at it in the way of like caring for your body, like taking that perspective back as someone who's caring for yourself, like caring for your body, what would be the kind thing to do kind of perspective in like a practical way, as well as a mental way. Like there's so many ways of kind of bringing that compassion in.
Yeah. And there's times where I've actually used you know, other conditions because the concept of the eating disorder can get in the way sometimes of somebody's interpretation of what you're saying, right? Because there's such a strong resistance or ambivalence or defensiveness You know, that sometimes we need to step away from the eating disorder to understand that. And like if someone was undergoing treatment for cancer, right, it's a really hard treatment. There's lots of things that people have to decide to do that are difficult when they undergo a cancer treatment, right? And so when you're undergoing that and you're struggling with the side effects and you're struggling with wanting to go to appointments and you're struggling with, you know, the effects that you have in between, would you criticize that person who's undergoing cancer treatment for having difficulty with struggling with that treatment? Or would you actually find a way to be compassionate towards that? And in the same way, I mean, eating disorder treatment is no different. It's difficult. It's a struggle. There's things, lots of things people don't like about it. But we know that those treatments are worthwhile in the long run, even though there's all of those difficulties along the way. So it's never for us to criticize somebody who struggles with treatment. And it's important that, in my view, that we encourage people to be compassionate about their response to treatment along the way as well. That's just one way in which I think about utilizing self-compassion.
That's a really great way, I will say. And I guess, what is some of the language that people could maybe use?
I don't know if you've heard of Anita Johnson. She's written Eating in the Light of the Moon.
I've had her on the podcast.
Oh, she, okay, yeah. So she is like one of my demigods in
Hawaii. She is.
Yes. Her use of language and metaphor is such a lovely way of supporting self-compassionate work. Like even the way that I think that part of the gentleness is, you know, did she use the log analogy, like the log in the river?
I don't think so.
You know, basically, she talks about getting into the river to swim, and that there's a log that's also in the water. But as you're swimming, you feel like you're being carried away by the current, and it starts to feel out of control. And so what you do is you grab onto the log because that's what's there. And then you realize that you know, some way down the track, that the log is actually getting in the way of you getting to shore. And people might be yelling at you from the shore saying, let go of the log, let go of the log, you can swim. But you're like, I'm too scared to let go. And so you might try swimming around the log. You might try letting go with one hand. You might try all these things while still holding onto the log, but you actually can't get away from the current because the log is part of what's keeping you in the current, right? And it's not until you get the confidence and the strength to know that you can swim without the log that you can get to the side of the river again and you can get to safety. And the log is, you know, the metaphor for the eating disorder, right? And when you use that, people can kind of go, oh, right. So when I try and go for a period of time with not binging and then I go back to binging, that's me holding back onto the log again. And it's like, yeah, because it makes you feel safe for some reason, right? So it's not that you're failing. It's that it helps you to feel safe and it's part of your survival strategy. And if you're using it as part of your survival strategy, what else do we need to work on that's going to make you feel strong enough and confident enough that you can let go of the log long enough to swim to the side? And that's where I think that real gentleness comes in. Like you don't have to say, like, oh, good on you, you grabbed onto the log again. We don't have to add criticism into it. You know, we can actually go, look, this is a compassionate response. It made you feel safe. It kept your head above water. I totally get why you would want to do that. And I also see that it's stopping you from progressing. What do you think? And I go, yeah, I know it holds me back, but I'm scared. All right, if you're scared, what do you need? It's a good companion to whatever kind of therapy you're using.
Yes, it definitely talks about how difficult it is to get off the log, how everything is kind of out of your control in those moments, and the safest thing to do is to hold on.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, she's great. Yeah.
I definitely love the metaphors, the visualizations. I think they can be so healing.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And that's why I love that little quote about, you know, the light and the darkness, the cool and the heat. The anger, hatred, and self-compassion. Like it's another way that it just helps break down the barriers that people have in their understanding of the eating disorder. It also allows families to be more compassionate to the struggles of somebody who's experienced the eating disorder as well. And you know, at the same time, I might say, well, you know, just like when you're swimming in that raging river, I could stand as a coach on the banks and tell you what to do, but I can't swim for you. And this is, you know, what I might use when people are struggling to engage in the therapy or stay in the therapy. Or they're saying, I'm not changing, this isn't working. Like, well, you know, I can't swim for you. If I could swim for you, I would do it. But the bottom line is you have to learn to swim, and you have to practice swimming, and you have to refine your technique, and you have to do stroke correction, and you have to do it repeatedly so you get stronger at swimming.
Yes. It's like each time you're going down the river, what skills have you learned to get out of the river and stay out of the river? Go to a resort, go somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right. So I just love her approach. Yeah, and Kristen Neff talks about compassion-focused therapy, which is like it's a therapy. I don't actually do it, but it's a therapy that helps to cultivate self-compassion. And it you know, talks about the different ways in which you can practice in order to strengthen your ability to be self-compassionate. And it's quite fascinating. They do it across you know, different mental health conditions. It's not just eating disorders, but eating disorders is recognized as one of those conditions that this compassion focused therapy can be useful in.
Yeah, and it's definitely an empowering tool once it is, you know, practiced and understood and able to be used.
Yeah, you just got to help people understand what's in it for them, why they might want to do it.
Yeah, because like you said, people are just repulsed by it straight away. Oh, self-compassion.
I know it's a hard word to be repulsed by it, but that's what you see in people with eating disorders. They can be absolutely repulsed by the idea of being nice to themselves.
Yeah, because it's just so out of their frame, out of their mind. Thing that's, yeah, it might be too far out of reach.
Yep. You know, our language is one where we need to foster collaboration, because in fact they are the expert in their experience. We might have some of the academic stuff, you know, on hand, but the academic stuff alone is not enough. And we know that people with eating disorders and their experience alone is not enough to recover. So we need to collaborate and use language that shows acceptance, inclusion, you know, a lack of stigma, a lack of bias, a lack of judgment, so that we can actually work together and help them be more compassionate and feel safe to explore what they need to explore in the therapy space.
Definitely. And about acknowledging those experiences or thoughts and having a safe space to kind of do that.
Yep. Yep.
And I guess could you talk a little bit about maybe the phrases that people might be able to use for self-compassion?
Phrases. So I will always bring that back to, what would I say to my friend? You know, so if someone's having a hard time, would I say, toughen up, everyone's got it harder than you? No, I wouldn't. I would say, wow, that seems really tough. What is it that I can do right now? is there something I can do right now that is going to help me in this moment? Is that going to lead to something that I can do for myself later? Or if I make a mistake, is it as bad as I think it is? What can I learn from this? So, I mean, I think that self-compassionate phrases or dialogue, it's something that I would practice with people in a session. And, you know, sometimes I say, okay, well, pretend your situation's happening to me. What would you say to me? Or we could do, you know, like an empty chair thing, you know, just pretend yeah. Such and such is sitting there.
And I like that it's like, it's okay to make a mistake. It's okay to go through something. Like the situation that you're going through is okay. It's not like bad and there's no way out of it. It's like, it's okay, can even be self-compassionate.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, I'm always reminding people that they're human beings. We are essentially non-perfect beings. We're meant to wax and wane in our ability to do things. And whether we're, you know, we can be brilliant at some times and not so brilliant at others. And that is absolutely in the realm of normal human experience. I mean, we can be proficient at times and we can be really rubbish at others. I try and draw on other experiences that people might have had. So it's great if they've learned, say, musical instrument. And I talk to them about learning that instrument and what it was like when they've, you know, when they've been learning. And if they're a very proficient musician, and say, well, what is it like when you start a new piece? Like you have the skills, but if you're starting a new piece, what is that like? And what does it require to get proficient? Right. And if you make a mistake when you're first learning a new piece, do you flog yourself for that? Or do you go, oh, that's because I just need to practice more? Or that's because I need to do whatever it is for my instrument? Right. Do you problem solve it? And people are able to draw on other experiences of how they might be self-compassionate in other areas of their lives.
Wow, that's a really great perspective to look at how they would look at other things to be able to then transfer that kind of perspective onto a different situation, especially like an emotional one.
And this is where a strengths-based perspective is so important in work with eating disorders.
Mm.
Because everyone does have their strengths. They have experiences where they are competent and confident and, you know, they can do things, but they don't necessarily, when they're in the throes of the eating disorder, they don't necessarily recognize that they still possess all of those other things. And so we're looking for transferable strengths.
Yes. And I also loved when you said like comforting yourself, like you're comforting a friend. I think that is such a great perspective to also bring in, considering you see so much empathy and compassion from people experiencing eating disorders, how if it, what that perspective was changed, how yes. That would be applied.
Yeah. Yeah. And it will take practice. You know, people aren't going to go from self-loathing to self-compassion, you know, after a 50-minute session. And as long as we have realistic expectations and we help the client have realistic expectations about that as well, then it, you know, it's such a useful thing to be able to help people come to an understanding of how to use self-compassion, how to talk in a self-compassionate way, and again that they already possess the skills to do it.
Yes. And I guess then, do you have maybe any advice for someone who is maybe kind of struggling to allow self-compassion into their life?
It comes back to understanding that compassion is part of our human experience, that it's a shared experience and that compassion is innate, but, you know, that we still have the opportunity to cultivate it. I think that, you know, there's people like Kristen Neff, right, who has done a lot of work in self-compassion, and she talks about self-kindness versus self-judgment. Right. And that self-kindness, you know, including that, can lead to less rumination, less perfectionism, less fear of failure. And I would curiously kind of say to people, well, might that be something that you're interested in? Would you be interested in having less rumination, in less perfectionism, in less fear of failure? What would it be like if you had less of those things in your life? And it's like, That could be good, you know. Is that a reason to work towards something like including more self-compassion in your life and self-kindness? And, you know, we as human beings struggle, right? We do struggle. And you can explore with anybody what is a time they have struggled in their life and they have succeeded despite the struggle. You can find something if you spend the time doing it, even for people who just say there's nothing, I've got nothing. You can still find it when you explore it and you take the time and you allow the person the time to actually go deep enough that they can find those things that they have succeeded in. And it really doesn't matter what that thing is. It doesn't have to be, you know, illustrated by receiving a trophy or an award or a, you know, I'm not necessarily talking about that. But a success can be anything that they've persevered with and come through. And then once somebody can see that they have had a time, even one time in their life, that they've done that, it's like, well, you know, it's the same for working on self-compassion. If you want it enough, if you see enough reasons for yourself to expand this into your life, then let's give it the time, let's give it the energy. And we can keep working on that.
Yes. And it's also like when people have been compassionate to you in a time of your life, that it can be so impactful. Have that support and compassion in being able to overcome it. So then to look at it, how you then have it for yourself, if you were able to apply that and the power that that can have during difficult times.
Yeah. Yeah. And for some people, they can find examples of times that other people have been compassionate to them and they can remember what that was like and it can help them go, all right, I can try this thing too. But we also then have people who have, you know, perhaps enormous amounts of trauma in their history, and their experience of receiving compassion might be quite scarce. So you might actually even move it on to, you know, was there, you know, a teacher or a sporting coach that they received it from? Was there a pet that they received it from? You know, we can find places to draw an experience from, and what would it be like if we could inject more of that into your life? But I truly believe that everybody has strengths that they can draw on if we take the time to actually help them find it. And then once they can identify with those and they can identify their why to actually keep pushing through and developing something like self-compassion, then it can be a really wonderful part of their growth and change and their ability to actually move forward in their lives as well.
Yes. And it's also quite like a spiritual concept, like you're saying, to be innate and bring that in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that there's people who will have, you know, that spiritual component to themselves, and you know, whether it's kindness to self or kindness to others, they might attach that to, you know, spirituality as well. And if that's important to them, then I would include that, right? But not everyone identifies with spirituality as well. So that's one of those things that we can kind of use fluidly, I think, in terms of self-compassion.
Yes, definitely up to each person.
Absolutely.
So for anyone who would like to find more information about you, where could they find you?
Well, I currently work out of Winoona Medical Practice. So it's just north of Wollongong. And I guess old Google is our friend these days, unlike when I first started my my university days. And yeah, so just Google my name and I suppose that's where I will pop up.
Well, thank you, Kathy. It has been such an incredible episode. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been really lovely chatting to you about it.
Well, that's the end of today's episode. Please subscribe, leave us a comment or a review. If you would also like to learn more about Body Matters services, you can check out our website at bodymatters.com.au. Thanks for listening.